Please get your Bibles and turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. In your pew Bible, that's page 770. 1 Corinthians 7. We're going to be looking at verses 17 through 24 in just a moment. I'm pinch hitting for Jim tonight. About midway through the week, it didn't look like Jim was getting any better from this infection he's had for the last couple of weeks, and so I'll be preaching tonight, although I think Jim would be fine. He looks like he's doing a lot better. We're thankful for that. We had a wonderful prayer service, full house this afternoon, and very excited about this meeting. We have so many opportunities, it seems, afforded to us because of this movie, it seems. So many people have told me about the acquaintances that they have, people at work. I think it was Bart telling me about someone. He was giving blood a week and a half ago, and the fellow next to him said, "Have you seen that movie?" You know. And there's so many people talking about Jesus right now, and it just seems to me that this is the perfect time for us to have a series on Jesus. And what better person to come and preach on Jesus than Brother Earnhardt. Probably two of my favorite preachers would be Sewell Hall and Paul Earnhardt, and I would love to hear either of them on this subject of Jesus. And I know Brother Earnhardt is going to do a wonderful job for us of helping us see Jesus and understand who He was and is, and why He suffered and died on the cross for us. So many people have come to me also telling me about all the successes of these home studies. And I think I've had so many positive things told me. I think I'm going to have a lesson pretty soon where just about half of it is just going to be a report of how these home studies are going, because you need to know about this. I mean, I'm encouraged, but you don't know, most of you, about what's going on in many of these studies. You've heard that about 20% of the attendance, total attendance, has been visitors. Now, if we had that for our meeting next week, we would be dancing in the streets. I mean, that is tremendous to have 20% visitors. And many of them have come back. We've had so many repeat visitors and good prospects that we're looking at now, and just thrilled about the success of these classes, and even more excited because of that about this gospel meeting. Let's read together in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, beginning in verse 17. Hold on just one moment. I knew there was something I forgot to say. Let me say one more thing. Many of you were not in the prayer service and did not hear. Dixie Hancock, who was baptized on Friday, we prayed for her in the prayer services last year. And I just want to say that because, you know, we speak these prayers and we say these names, and I think we need to be reminded of the power that God has to work in people's lives. And I believe with all my heart that that was an answer to prayer on Friday. Okay, let's read verses 17 through 24. "But as God has distributed to each one, as the Lord has called each one, so let him walk, and so I ordain in all the churches. Was anyone called while circumcised? Let him not become uncircumcised. Was anyone called while uncircumcised? Let him not be circumcised. Circumcision is nothing and uncircumcision is nothing, but keeping the commandments of God is what matters. Let each one remain in the same calling in which he was called. Were you called while a slave? Do not be concerned about it, but if you can be made free, rather use it. For he who is called in the Lord while a slave is the Lord's freedman. Likewise, he who is called while free is Christ's slave. You were bought at a price. Do not become slaves of men. Brethren, let each one remain with God in that state in which he was called." Seems that we're never satisfied with what we have. We always want something more. If we have an old car, we want a new car. If we have a new car, we want a better car. If we're driving a compact, we want a midsize. If we're driving a midsize, we want a minivan. If we're driving a minivan, we want an SUV. And once we get this big vehicle, we worry about all the gas we're having to buy. If we're living in a trailer, we want an apartment. If we're living in an apartment, we want a condo. If we buy a condo, we want a house. If we get a house, we want a bigger house. And once we get the big house, we worry about having to clean it. If we're making $25,000 a year, we want 50. If we're making 50, we want 75. If we're single, we want to be married. If we're married, we may want to be single. If we're young, we want to be old. If we're old, we wish we were young. If we're tall, we wish we were shorter. If we're short, we wish we were taller. If we're a redhead, we wish we were a brunette. If we're a brunette, we wish we were blonde. And if we're blonde, we have to suffer all these jokes about blonde. And this problem of being dissatisfied is not unique to us today. It goes back all the way to the beginning. You think about it, Adam and Eve were living in the Garden of Eden. It doesn't get any better than that. They were living in the paradise of God. There was just one thing they couldn't have, and that was the thing that they wanted. And that's the way it seems to be with us. It doesn't matter how blessed we are, it doesn't matter how much we have, there's always something more that we want. What does the Bible say about this attitude? Well, it says a lot of things, but one of the things the Bible says is that you can't find happiness without contentment. Better a handful with quietness, Ecclesiastes 4 and verse 6 says, than both hands full together with toil and grasping for the wind. And I think what he has in mind there is we've got both hands full, but we're trying to find satisfaction, more things. And the fact of the matter is, if you have riches, if you're not content with those riches, you're not going to be enjoying those riches, because you're going to be seeking more and more. You can't enjoy the car that you have because you want a better car. You can't enjoy the house that you have because you want a bigger house. And on it goes. And so it is in life. But that's not really what I want to focus on tonight. What I want to focus on is another thing the Bible says about this attitude of always wanting more. What the Bible tells us is that the only thing that matters in life is our spiritual relationship with God. That's what we're told here in 1 Corinthians 7, verses 17 through 24. That our circumstances in life are really insignificant. And the reason why those circumstances are insignificant are really twofold. First of all, life is short. Compared to eternity, life is a blip on the screen. It's like a vapor that appears for a while and then vanishes away. Eternity is so long, anything that we endure in this life is meaningless by comparison. But another thing that the Bible tells us about the reason why our spiritual condition is so much more important than our physical condition is that the Bible recognizes that the things of this world do not satisfy our deepest longings. It doesn't matter how much money you have. It doesn't matter how nice your car is. It doesn't matter how great your marriage is. It doesn't matter how wonderful your job is. It's not going to fill the void that's in our heart that really, I believe, has been placed there by God. The only thing that can fill that void is God. And without a relationship with God, it is a grasping for the wind. And so if our relationship with God is primary, the most important thing, then that elevates obedience above everything else. And obedience is not easy. It's tough. It's costly, and it involves sacrifice. But it's worth it. Whatever sacrifice we have to make, whatever pain we have to endure, however difficult our circumstances in life may be, it's all worth it, because heaven is what it's all about. Being with God is what it's all about. And so what we're going to do in this lesson is look at 1 Corinthians 7. And 1 Corinthians 7 is about marriage. And we're going to talk about marriage, but that's not going to be the only application we make from this chapter, because verses 17 through 24 are principles that can be applied to all the decisions that we make in our life. So we're going to make some pointed comments about marriage, but we're going to talk about everything, at least in principle, tonight. So let's look, first of all, at the instructions, that kind of the context of verses 17 through 24, the instructions that Paul gives about marriage. The first thing he says in verse 1, he says, "Now concerning the things of which you wrote to me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman." And it becomes clear later that what he's talking about when he says it's not good for a man to touch a woman, he's talking about marriage. He's saying it's better for you to remain single. Now, let me say this about the first phrase, "now concerning the things of which you wrote to me." We have to remember that all of these responses from Paul are responses to a written letter that they had given to him. And we don't have that letter. We don't have these questions. And so it's kind of like listening to one end of a telephone conversation. You know, it's hard to know exactly what the issue was. But the answers that Paul gives are clear enough that we know the principles, at least, behind these instructions. And, of course, the advice and the instructions are clear as well. But we need to remember that when we're looking at this passage. The next thing he instructs is to the unmarried and to the widows. He applies this teaching to them. He says in verse 8, "But I say to the unmarried and to the widows, it is good for them if they remain, even as I am." And Paul was single. "But if they cannot exercise self-control, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion." He makes it clear that he's not giving orders, saying it's wrong for you to marry. He's giving his advice. He's saying it's better for you to remain this way. And he suggests benefits to singleness, but he's not saying that singleness is necessarily more holy than marriage. And he also says that it's not for everyone. Living a celibate life may create problems for you in the flesh because of passion, because of sexual immorality. It may be better for some to marry. He then talks to the married in verses 10 and 11. He says, "Now to the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord, a wife is not to depart from her husband. But even if she does depart, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband. And a husband is not to divorce his wife." And that's basically exactly what Jesus said in his ministry. He says, "Yet not I, but the Lord." This is the Lord's instructions. You are not to divorce. You are to remain with your mate. And then he speaks to those in mixed marriages, and mixed marriages are where a brother or sister is married to an unbeliever. He says in verse 12, "But to the rest, I, not the Lord, say, if any brother has a wife who does not believe and she is willing to live with him, let him not divorce her. And a woman who has a husband who does not believe, if he is willing to live with her, let her not divorce him." So the instruction is the same. If you're married to an unbeliever, that may be very difficult for you, but you are still not given the right to divorce that person because Jesus said that was wrong. The difference, though, in what he's saying to the mixed marriages versus what he said to those who were married to believers is found in verses 15 and 16. He says, "But if the unbeliever departs, let him depart. A brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God has called us to peace." While to the believers, to those married to believers, he said, remain unmarried or be reconciled to your husband. To those married to unbelievers, he says, if they depart, let them depart. You're not under bondage in such cases. And I think we'll come to understand exactly why he gives that instructions a little bit later. He then addresses the virgins in verses 25 and 26. He says, "Now concerning virgins, I have no commandment from the Lord, yet I give judgment as one whom the Lord in His mercy has made trustworthy. I suppose, therefore, that this is good because of the present distress, that it is good for a man to remain as he is." Now that's where some of this dialogue starts to take shape and starts to make sense. What's this all about? Well, it very well could be that what this was about was there was this distress. Some have suggested this was a famine going on in that area of the world. Some have suggested this was intense persecution coming from unbelievers to Christians. But whatever it was, you have this terrible distress that's making it very difficult for people who are married. It's not easy to live the Christian life with a mate. He explains what he's talking about, or why he's giving this instruction in verse 27. He says, and following. He says, "Are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be loosed. Are you loosed from a wife? Do not seek a wife. But even if you do marry, you have not sinned. And if a virgin marries, she has not sinned. Nevertheless, such will have trouble in the flesh. But I would spare you. But this I say, brethren, the time is short, so that from now on even those who have wives should be as though they had none, those who weep as though they did not weep, those who rejoice as though they did not rejoice, those who buy as though they did not possess, and those who use this world as not misusing it. For the form of this world is passing away." He says everything is changing. And it's going to be very difficult for you if you're married to remain faithful to the Lord. And so he says, I want to make this easy on you. And that's why I'm giving you this advice. Imagine, if you will, Paul were writing to Jewish Christians who were living in Nazi Germany in the 1930s, right before it got really bad. And he's saying, the form of this world is, your world's going to be turned upside down. Things are going to be very difficult for you. And as Lightfoot commented in his commentary, a man who is a hero in himself becomes a coward when he thinks of his widowed wife and children. Imagine a believer standing before the magistrate and the judge says, "You renounce Christ or I'm going to kill you. But before I kill you, I'm going to kill your wife, and I'm going to kill your children, and I'm going to make you watch it." That would be difficult. And I don't know that's what's going on in Corinth, but you can see why he would say, if there is this terrible distress going on, it's better for you not to have a mate. That is the context of what he writes in verses 17 through 24. Now, what he writes in verses 17 through 24 comes right on the heels of what he told to those who were married to unbelievers. I believe they had the most difficult time. It's one thing if you're married to a believer during a difficult circumstance. It's another thing entirely if you're married to someone who does not understand what you're all about. They don't believe in heaven. They don't believe in hell. They don't believe in God, perhaps. And they don't understand why you're willing to suffer so much and cause the family so much suffering. And so he tells them, don't divorce your unbelieving husband or wife, but if they depart, let them depart. He says in verse 16, "For how do you know, O wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, O husband, whether you will save your wife? Let them go. I know you're probably the best chance they have of ever being saved, but don't put your soul in jeopardy by trying to hold on to a marriage that's going to be a detriment to your soul, that's going to be a discouragement to you." And to give perspective to all this, he gives us verses 17 through 24, which is really the heart and the foundation of everything he says in this entire chapter. And let's look at what he says. He says, basically, remain in the calling with which you're called. That principle is repeated three times in this section, verses 17, verses 20, and verses 24. In verse 17, he says, "But as God has distributed to each one, as the Lord has called each one, so let him walk, and so are ordained in all the churches." In verse 20, he says, "Let each one remain in the same calling in which he was called." And there he's using called and calling in two different senses. He uses the word call or called or calling nine times in this short paragraph. Eight times he uses it in reference to salvation. Here, the first time in verse 20, he's speaking of your vocation, your circumstances in life. He says, remain in the same calling, whatever that is, in which you are called. Specifically talking about marriage, he says, if you're married, stay married. If you're not married, don't marry. That's basically all he's saying. But the reasons why he gives these instructions in verses 17 and verses 20 and verses 24 are really revealed in what's in between. I hope this is not too crude an analogy, but think of this passage kind of like a Big Mac, like a triple-decker sandwich. You've got these three statements of the principle. Remain with God in the calling with which you're called. And then in between, he gives some examples of that. Of course, in the whole context, he's talking about marriage, but between verses 17 and verses 20, he refers to circumcision and uncircumcision. He applies this to the Jews and to the Gentiles. He says in verse 18, was anyone called while circumcised? Let him not become uncircumcised. Was anyone called while uncircumcised? Let him not be circumcised. What in the world is he talking about? How in the world does someone who is circumcised become uncircumcised? That's physically impossible. What he's saying is, you don't need to change who you are. He says if you're a Jew, you don't have to be a Gentile to be a Christian. That's what we talked about last week, talking about how to talk to Jews. A lot of Jews think that if they become Christians, that's surrendering their culture, that they can't be a Jew anymore, that being a Christian is synonymous with being a Gentile. But he says, was anyone called circumcised? Let him not become uncircumcised. You don't have to become a Gentile. And if you're a Gentile, if you're uncircumcised, you don't have to become a Jew. Why? Because it doesn't matter. Verse 19, circumcision is nothing and uncircumcision is nothing. What is it all about? He says, but keeping the commandments of God is what matters. And applying that to our situation today, we would tell our Jewish friends, you don't have to become like us. You just need to follow Jesus. And we would tell our Mexican friends, we don't want you to become American. We want you to follow Jesus. And we would tell our Chinese friends, we don't want to make you just like Anglo-Saxon people. We want you to follow Jesus. Obeying God is what matters. James was sharing with me before services a little piece he got off of the internet entitled Why I Left the Church of Christ. And of course he's using that term Church of Christ in a denominational way. I have no interest in people following the Church of Christ. I'm not concerned if you don't want to be with the Church of Christ. I'm concerned about people following Jesus. That's what my concern is. Obeying God is what matters, not obeying men or conforming to some social standards or customs or traditions. That's not what we're all about. Now, in the next section, between verses 20 and verses 24, he applies this to slavery. Verse 21, were you called while a slave? Do not be concerned about it. But if you can be made free, rather use it. So he says, are you a slave? That's terrible. And slavery at this time was sometimes very, very difficult. You know, Peter writes in 1 Peter chapter 2 about slaves who do what is right and are beaten in spite of them doing what was right. They did nothing wrong, but they're beaten. Could you imagine having that kind of work environment? Were you called while a slave? Don't be concerned about it. He says if you can be made free, use it. Now, a lot of people have misinterpreted this to say that Paul is saying that slavery is somehow more virtuous than being free. He's not saying that. He's just saying, in the final analysis, it doesn't make any difference whether you're a slave or whether you're free. A slave can go to heaven just as well as a free person can go to heaven. And furthermore, in verse 22, he says, he who is called in the Lord while a slave is the Lord's freed man. Likewise, he who is called while free is Christ's slave. And so he tells that slave, you're free. And you're free in the most important way. You're free from sin. You're free from the devil. And likewise, he tells the free man, you remember, you're a slave. You're a slave to the Lord. And so he's telling them that their spiritual circumstances are much more important than their physical circumstances. In all of this, he emphasizes obedience. In verse 19, as we said, keeping the commandments of God is what matters. And then in verse 23, he says the same thing in a little different way. In verse 23, he says, you were bought at a price. Do not become slaves of men. In verse 20 of chapter 6, he said the same thing. You were bought at a price. In other words, don't become slaves of men in a spiritual way. Don't let anyone or anything cause you to go back to that old slavery, the worst form of slavery, slavery to sin. You just keep obeying God, no matter what your circumstances may be. Well, let's see how this applies to us. Let's bring this lesson home in a practical way. I think the first thing that Paul is saying here is that we need to keep an eternal perspective in life. Why? Because this life is so short and eternity is long. And that undergirds everything that he says. He says to those who are married, don't divorce. He even tells those who may be in very difficult and trying marriages not to divorce. Why? Because it's not the main thing. Yes, it might be more helpful and convenient and more comfortable for you in this life if you were to leave that person. But why surrender your soul for that? Why give up your relationship with God for that? And then he tells those who are not married, yes, there are many benefits to marriage, and you would enjoy marriage, but you know, if you were to marry under these circumstances, it's going to hinder you as well. It's going to be a hindrance to you. It's going to be a burden to you. And I don't want you to be burdened. I want you to be able to worship God without any kind of hindrance. And so he tells them, keep an eternal perspective. And you know, we need to do the same thing in our lives, in whatever decision we're making. In marriage, we need to marry someone with a view toward heaven. And we don't need to choose someone just because they're good looking or they have money or even for some of the more noble reasons we might marry. Even if someone is a very good person and they love you dearly and they love you completely and they're going to be such a wonderful helper to you in so many ways, I'm not saying you won't be blessed in that relationship. But if that person isn't going to help you get to heaven, you need to seriously consider that. You need to think twice before you marry someone that is not going to help you get to heaven. You need to think about this when you choose your career or when you're faced with a job change, moving to another city or what have you. You need to think about eternity when making entertainment choices. You need to think about heaven when making choices regarding your education. In every decision, we have to ask, what's going to help me get to heaven? And not all decisions are cut and dried. And I appreciate the way that Paul does that in this chapter. Read just a few verses with me. In verse 6, he says, I say this as a concession, not as a commandment. In verses 25 and 26, we read a moment ago, he says, I have no commandment from the Lord, yet I give judgment as one whom the Lord in His mercy has made trustworthy. He says, I suppose, therefore, that this is good for the presence. He's not saying dogmatically, this is the way that it is, this is the way it has to be. He says, I'm giving my judgment. It's not perfectly cut and dried one way or the other. I'm giving my judgment. Again, in verse 40, the last verse of the chapter, just in case you missed it, he repeats himself again. He says, she is happier if she remains as she is, she remains single, according to my judgment. And notice he says, and I think I also have the Spirit of God. And isn't that the way we have to make a lot of decisions in life? Isn't that the way we have to make most of our decisions in life? Most of our decisions in life are not a matter of sin and righteousness. This is wrong and this is right. Most of our decisions in life are judgments. Even the ordinary mundane decisions in life that we make. It's not a choice between good and evil. Many times it's a choice between something that is morally neutral and another thing that is morally neutral. And what we have to do is decide what is good and what is better, and what is better and what is best. And in all of those decisions say, what is going to be the best decision regarding my eternal salvation with God? What's going to help me become a better Christian? Is this going to be a hindrance? Or is this just going to be something that kind of holds me back? Something that's not going to help me excel and draw closer to God? Is it wrong to go to this movie? Well, it may not be, but it may not be something to help us. Is it wrong to take this job? It may not be wrong, but it might not be helpful. Is it wrong to buy this car, to buy this house, to marry this person? I'm not saying it's not that easy to say, is it right or is it wrong? The question is, will it help me get to heaven? Another thing Paul tells us is to take advantage of the opportunities that we have. That becomes very clear in verse 21. He says, were you called while a slave? Do not be concerned about it. But if you can be made free, rather use it. He says, take advantage of that opportunity if you're given your freedom. Paul is not in this chapter pro-slavery or anti-slavery. He's neutral on the subject. But he says to the slave, if you can be made free, take advantage of that. He's not pro-marriage or anti-marriage. He's saying if it's better for you to be married, marry. If it's better for you not to be married, don't marry. That's what he's trying to say. He's not pro-Jew or anti-Jew or pro-Gentile or anti-Gentile. It's interesting to me that Paul acted like Jews around Jews and he acted like Gentiles around Gentiles. Why? Because of what he said in chapter 9 and verse 22. He says, to the weak I became as weak that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all men that I might by all means save some. Now this I do for the gospel's sake, that I may be partaker of it with you. And so he made that choice based on the spiritual. He made those decisions based on the spiritual. He chose the single life for the same reason. I believe Paul looked at his life and perhaps he had had opportunities to marry. But he said it's going to be more helpful in my ministry to remain single. Paul found himself in chains. He found himself in prison several times. And he used his Roman citizenship to get out of those situations. Why? Because it was better for the work of God. That's the way he made all of these decisions in life. And so, if you are single and you find an eligible mate who will help you spiritually, who will help you serve God better, who will help your faith to grow, then marry that person. If you find a new job that will afford you more opportunities in the Lord's work to help you grow as a Christian, will afford you perhaps more money that you can use for the Lord's work, be able to give you more flexibility in going and helping in different things, or the location may be better for you spiritually, then by all means take that job. Take that opportunity. If you can afford a bigger house that will enable you to show hospitality, buy the house. Take advantage of the opportunities. But in whatever case it might be, obey God regardless of your situation. If you don't get the mate that's going to help you serve God, obey God. If you don't get the job, obey God. If you don't get the house, obey God. If you don't get whatever it is that might be helpful to you in whatever way, in whatever circumstance, simply obey God. It's interesting what he said in verse 17. He said, as God has distributed to each one. That's an interesting word. In my studies, I found that this word distribute means to bestow. To apportion to one his share of something. God has, in one way or some fashion or another, put us exactly where we are right now. Whether we're married or whether we're single, whether we have a good job, whether we have a crummy job, whether we're living in a great house or whether we're living in a terrible house, whether we're living, 50 miles from Embry Hills or whether we're living just down the street from Embry Hills. God is involved in that. God is involved in your life and He is involved in your life for a purpose. And there may be a reason why you don't find the marriage that you would like, get the job you would like, find the house that you would like. There may be a reason for that. And if you wait until everything gets just the way that you would like it, you're going to miss the opportunities that God has placed before you to serve Him in those unique circumstances, which may be less than desirable. We've got all kinds of people here at Embry Hills. We've got young people and old people. We've got educated and uneducated. We've got single. We've got married. We've got widowed. We've got divorced. We've got parents with children. We've got parents with no children. We've got single parents. We've got parents with young children. We've got parents with grown children. We've got rich people. We've got poor people. We've got people who have big houses, people who have no houses. We've got people with good jobs, people with crummy jobs. We've got people with no jobs. I mean, we've got people in all kinds of circumstances. We've got black people and white people. We've got people who are from this country. We have people who are not from this country. And you may or may not like where you are right now and your circumstances in life. But what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7 is it's not important. What is important is that you obey God wherever you are. Don't wait until you get what you want to obey God. God doesn't just use people who are exactly where they want to be. Look at the Bible. He used rich people like Solomon and Abraham. He used poor people like Joseph and Mary. And the widow who put in her two mites in the treasury. He used married men like Peter. He used single men like Paul. He used women who were fertile and could have lots of children. He used women who were barren. And how many examples of that do you have in the Scriptures? He used mothers who had strong husbands to support them in raising their children, like Elizabeth, who had Zacharias to help her raised John the Baptist to be the strong spiritual leader that he was. But he also used mothers who had no help from their husband. Apparently Eunice had no help from her husband in raising Timothy. But look at what Timothy became. The fact of the matter is, God used people where they were, and many times because of the circumstances that they had. Joseph and Mary's poverty was very important. I think it was essential in raising Jesus. Paul's singleness helped him in his work. The infertility of those women in the Old Testament had a purpose and a reason. The fact that Timothy came from a mixed marriage, I believe, helped him in his work in relating with others. Those circumstances were necessary. But if those people had been disobedient, those opportunities would have been lost. And so my call for all of us is to obey God wherever we are. And let's just make it a little more practical. What's your burden right now? Finances? You have a job you don't like? Are you unemployed? You got family conflicts in your life? Are you lonely? You've got basically two choices. Whatever your situation might be, you can either, one, dwell on your situation. You can let your circumstances hold you back and just wait for something to change, for those financial problems to go away, for that job to change to a better job, for those family conflicts to be resolved, for you to find a job if you're unemployed, or fill the void that's left by loneliness. You can wait for that to change. Or you can turn what is a negative situation into a positive. These circumstances in your life can serve as a spiritual wake-up call for you. It may be that this is the chastisement of God. I'm not saying that it is. But I'm saying the Bible plainly says that God chastises those whom He loves. And if you're not chastised, you're not a son. These circumstances may represent an evangelistic opportunity of some sort. It may be that by going through this family conflict, someone may be saved. It's happened because of good examples. It may be that you're at a terrible job where you're suffering a lot of injustices. But if you faithfully obey God, and do it from the perspective that you're doing this work to the Lord and not to men, as Ephesians 6 and Colossians 3 says, that someone will see that example and be inspired by it and become a New Testament Christian. We can't know what God's purpose is, but we do know that the only way it can work out for good is if we follow Him and obey Him. So what is it that drives your life? What is the most important thing, as the title of our lesson says? What is that one thing that makes you get up out of bed every morning? Is it something that's holding you back? Are you looking for comfort? Are you looking for happiness? Are you looking for fulfillment or love or peace or things? I hope that I can cause you tonight to stop and think that what ought to drive your life is God and your relationship with God. I want to close with the last verse in our text, 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 24, and pay careful attention to what he says. He says, "Brethren, let each one remain with God in that state in which he was called." What it's all about is being with God, no matter what state you are in. Are you with God tonight? Get your songbooks. Do you have a relationship with God? Are you a child of God? Have you come to Jesus? We're going to sing this song. Come to Jesus. He will save you. Have you come to Jesus? As I said just a moment ago, I'm not appealing to you to come to the Church of Christ. That's the last thing I would want you to do. I appeal to you to come to Jesus. I am appealing to you through Christ. This is the Lord's invitation. He's appealing to you tonight to come to Him. And what He has said is very simple. He said, "He who believes and is baptized shall be saved." We saw that on Friday. A lady came on her lunch break, associate with James. Dixie came. She confessed that she believed that Jesus Christ was the Son of God. She was immersed in water. She rose up a new creature. And that can be you tonight if you're not a child of God. Or if you need to do as Damone did so beautifully this morning, confessing your sins or just simply asking for the prayers of the saints, you can do that as well. But whatever you need, do it right now as together we stand and sing.
Come to Jesus.